This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 21st, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. In a few minutes on the program, excerpts from a conversation recorded at the Fayetteville Public Library last month when Pulitzer Prize winner David Shipler discussed his book, The Working Poor, in front of members of several of the region's book clubs. He was in Fayetteville as part of the annual One Book, One Community project. That's just ahead. KUAF is supported by Urban Jungle Tropical Plant Care and Rental, offering a variety of indoor plants for residential or commercial space and serving Northwest Arkansas with maintenance-free month-to-month care and services. Photos and information available at urbanjunglenwa.com or 466-5033. Support also comes from To Enjoy Magazine, a monthly publication offering local arts, culture, and entertainment. The second annual Crystal Bridges Museum commemorative issue is now available. To Enjoy thanks everyone for their positive response over the past 3 years. Subscriptions and more information are available at 464-8900 or numeral 2enjoymag.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Last month, the One Book, One Community series of events in Fayetteville married town and gown with conversation, discussions, and panels inspired by the book The Working Poor by David Shipler. The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer spent many years at the New York Times, and he spent years researching and interviewing people for the book about individuals, couples, and families living near or below the poverty level. He gave a public lecture on the University of Arkansas campus, and just before his visit to the region ended, he sat down with me at the Fayetteville Public Library for a conversation. Our audience was the annual gathering of the groups, members of several of the area's book clubs. Here are some of the highlights of that conversation.
We have what we call the American Dream, which is a myth. But myths are very useful in societies, and we have quite a few of them in ours. Other countries have them. Our myth is that if you work hard, you will prosper. It's a very powerful myth. It's a wish. Richard Wright called it the truth of the power of the wish. The truth of the power of the wish. And it's important and useful not because it's actually real, but because it sets a very high standard. And the gap between that high standard and the reality is a gap that we yearn to close, I think, most of us. The trouble is that it's only one side of a coin, that the other side is the anti-myth. Because if it's true that everyone who works hard can prosper, then logically it is suggested that if you're not prospering, you're not working hard. And so this myth and anti-myth collide and grate against one another and form the foundations or the framework of what would be loosely called our political debate about poverty, to the extent that we have one, where each end of the spectrum is, I think, trapped in a particular ideological mindset that obscures the more complex reality, which is full of contradictions and ambiguities, as reality always is, which is one of the reasons that I write these books, to challenge my own preconceptions and discover complications. Because it's intellectually rewarding to see that real life doesn't fit neatly into preconceived boxes.
You mentioned complexity. When you read about the people that you visited with, and often, you realize that many of them had so many different obstacles to get out of poverty, to become something beyond the situation they were in. You mentioned Kara King, I think it was, who was in New Hampshire, who became ill, and she had epilepsy, was not supposed to drive, but in order to have a job, she had to, because she lived in rural America where there wasn't public transportation. All these things that stack up to work against somebody.
Yeah, I mean, the problems that families in poverty face are interrelated, and they magnify one another, and they create chain reactions that sometimes are related in surprising ways. I mean, Kara was an example of that, but Another woman in New Hampshire I met, Lisa Brooks, had a slightly different set of issues. She had a full-time job working as an aide in a group home for mentally ill adults. And she made, at that time, $8.21 an hour. She had full health insurance, but every dime that came in went out. She had no savings. And so when she had to move into a drafty wooden house, her son's asthma worsened. There's been a lot of research in the last 20 years on the relationship between housing and children's asthma, asthma being a problem that's exacerbated by certain antigens in houses, such as dust mites and mold and roaches that shed their skin into a fine dust and trigger attacks. And twice her son had to be rushed by ambulance to the hospital. Her insurance company, for reasons she never was able to understand, paid for the emergency room treatment, but not the ambulance. And that cost $240 one time, $250 the next. Lisa couldn't pay either. She had no savings. And so those charges damaged her credit report. And when she needed to get a new car, because her old car died, and she needed it to get to work, she needed a new used car, she went to a reputable car dealer, and the salesman ran a credit check and said, "I'm sorry, I can't make you a car loan." So she ended up at a sleazy used car lot where they didn't run credit checks, but they charged her 15.75% interest on a car loan. Now, this was some years ago when interest rates were higher, but by coincidence, she told me this right around the time I had received an unsolicited offer in the mail for a car loan at half that rate, which demonstrates the fact that people are like businesses when they borrow money. Healthy businesses can float bonds with AAA ratings. These folks are not rated AAA. This morning I was having breakfast with some people from the law school at the university and a couple of legal aid attorneys who were explaining that there are certain sort of credit protection subscriptions that you can sign up for that cost when you buy something at a store like a computer or something like that, and you pay $17 a month or $19 a month to protect your credit, supposedly. And a lot of low-income people do this, but they end up paying huge amounts of money for virtually no protection. So there are lots of scams. There are lots of problems that people get into financially, partly because they're not aware, they're not sophisticated, they may not understand even what interest rate is, because there are some people who do financial education who say, you say, well, you're paying the equivalent of 300% a year interest on this 2-week advance payment on your tax return refund, the H&R Block might charge you for, and that doesn't register because folks don't know what interest is. They don't understand that that's an exorbitant amount. So there's a tremendous amount of exploitation that can occur, and these problems, this chain reaction from one problem to the next is part of what I've come to think of and other people have called the ecology of poverty. It's kind of like an ecological system of relationships among individuals, their families, their neighborhoods, their schools, government services, the private sector, and so forth.
Your book is not a policy book, but very subtly and almost always there is discussion of policy, but that's because it's about people. You spent time with people. This wasn't a hit and run. You didn't go in, talk to someone for an afternoon and leave. How would you find the people that would talk to you and visit with you over a kitchen table, and what were the relationships like?
Well, my sociology professors would not approve of my methodology because it was very unscientific. What I did was go to organizations that were working in the anti-poverty field, whether job training programs, home visiting programs, housing authorities, medical clinics, and so forth. And I would ask, first I asked them if they could recommend some people who would be good to interview, and that didn't work well because the organizations were understandably protective of their clients and didn't want some reporter coming in and being a voyeur. So I changed my initial pitch and I said, "All right, I'm interested in finding out about your programs. What do you do?" And of course they were very happy to talk about those. And I actually was also interested in their programs. It wasn't a lie. It was not my ultimate goal, though. And when people would talk about issues and the problems they were seeing, I'd ask them if they knew anyone who might be willing to talk to me about those particular problems. And they'd say, well, we'll check, and they would. And invariably, people said yes. And then I decided it would be a good idea to follow them for some years, because people's memories play tricks on them. And it's better to observe what's happening than to trust recollections that may be some years old. So I went back to the same people again and again, to the extent possible. I mean, it wasn't always possible. People were not 100% willing to have me intrude on their lives all the time. But, you know, enough were that I was able to get a sense of how their situations developed over time.
How big a role, because many of the people you talked to had jobs, had full-time jobs, or close to full-time jobs, but what role do low wages play in the inability to get out of a bad situation?
Well, you know, that great economist Woody Allen said that poverty is a tragedy, especially from the financial point of view. Money is the centerpiece of the issue. It, you know, the low wages are endemic in service industries and many retail industries. It's not, and by the way, the legal aid lawyers were telling me that there is a terrible, and one of the lawyers at the law school, that there's a terrible problem of companies stealing wages from people, in effect, by just not paying them their wages. So there's a lot of litigation on that and so forth, but you know that compounds the low wage problem. If you look at the statistics, you see that this year a family of four, headed by a single adult, an adult with three children, has to have an income of $22,050 to be at the poverty line. Now, if you work a full-time job, 40 hours a week, and many people can't get that many hours, that comes out, as I recall, to $10.63 an hour, something like that. Think about that. That's a pretty high wage for people working in low-skilled jobs. The federal minimum wage is $7.25. So a single adult working in a low-skilled job, probably with three kids, will probably be below the poverty line. And the poverty line is artificially low because it's based on family spending in the 1950s when the average family spent about a third of its income for food. Now the expenditure is about a sixth or a seventh for food. Housing has become a much bigger cost. So, you know, the income is supplemented by certain government programs. People can get Medicaid, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, for their kids, food stamps, now called SNAP. Food stamps, by and large, families would tell me, took them into the second or third week of the month, but not beyond, usually. Housing subsidies, but they're inadequate. Section 8 vouchers with which you can rent on the private market. But if you're not public housing, affordable housing, but if you're not getting housing subsidies, and you're working at a low wage, you're really in trouble. I don't know what rents are like around here, but in many parts of the country, low-income families on the market are paying 50 to 70% of their income for rent. And that's not an optional payment. They've got to write that check every month. They've got to make the car payment every month. They've got to pay the electric bill. They've got to pay the cable bill if they want to participate in the American Forum. You know, that's the window into the outside world. And the part of the budget that can be squeezed is for food. So there's a high correlation, one big study found, between low-income families without housing subsidies and underweight children. And as you all probably know, malnutrition, when it occurs during the last two trimesters of pregnancy and or the first 2 years of life, during critical periods of brain development, can have lifelong cognitive effects. So you see these disparate problems, housing to malnutrition. It's very logical and obvious when you lay it out, but by and large, we don't think of it that way. We think of these issues as separate and existing in discrete categories, and that's the way government services are also set up to address the problems in discrete categories.
You mentioned cable television. One of the chapters, you have discussions with people who, some people who had been very poor and not as poor anymore, some people who are poor, and the different opinions about people who have cable television or pets, and how some people think that if you have not much money, you shouldn't have cable television at all. It was a very interesting discussion.
Yes, I found people who had been in poverty who were working with the poor in anti-poverty organizations much more open to criticizing people in poverty for bad decisions and mismanaging their money than middle class folks who were working in these organizations who I guess felt they didn't want to be disdainful. But once the subject was opened up, then there was a chorus of complaints. I think when you know, the people who really know these issues the best are the people at the grassroots level who actually work in agencies that try to help folks. I think they see past the ideological categories. They understand that both the society and individuals have failed and made mistakes. And therefore, whatever solutions we come up with have to address that whole spectrum of you know, areas of responsibility. There is a kind of, attitude that poor people shouldn't have enjoyment. A woman, Anne Brash, I wrote about, who grew up in the middle class and then fell into poverty after a divorce, told me that her relatives were very indignant when she went and bought strawberries, for example. It seemed like an indulgence that she wasn't morally entitled to because she was poor. And I think the same could be said about cable TV or other things like that. There was one couple I wrote about who got their earned income tax credit payment from the IRS. Most people said, I'm going to use it to, people say, when I get my taxes, you know, it's like, when I get my taxes, I do not say that. I don't say when I get my taxes. But when I get my taxes, I'm going to pay my bill, my electric bill. When I get my taxes, I'm going to buy new furniture. This couple, when they got their taxes, they got tattoos. And a friend of mine who's an economist in Washington who is a very strong proponent of the earned income tax credit, when he read the book said, oh, I really wish you hadn't put that in.
But one thing that came through to me in the book is that we all make bad decisions. It's just some people have a smaller margin of error than others.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, I once, after I left the Times, I kept a monthly budget and looked at where my money was going. It was pretty shocking. But I had a cushion, you know, and people who don't have a cushion get into trouble very, very quickly. And sometimes not through their own fault. If a car breaks down and they can't get to work, they could lose their job, and or if it has to go into the shop, or they're child gets sick and they don't have any plan B for daycare and that sort of thing. It just puts them into a downward spiral.
You mentioned how so many things are connected, and one theme that came through is sexual abuse and how that is a huge problem in the United States.
I think it's an epidemic, probably not just in the United States, and I think it probably crosses all socioeconomic lines. I was quite surprised that most of the women I interviewed, when I asked them about their childhood, told me they had been sexually abused by their fathers or their stepfathers or their mother's boyfriends or an older brother in a foster family. And my wife is a social worker, and I said to her, I don't understand why they're telling me this. I didn't ask this question. I'm a stranger. And she said, that's why, because you're a stranger. You're safe. You don't know the families. You're not going to have contact with them. And I think that was true because we were talking, these folks and I, about poverty and about their particular situations. And my question underlying everything was, how did you get here? Why are you here? And for many of these women, that abuse was a factor. Sometimes they would say, I can't have a good relationship with a man. I don't have a sense of trust, because perhaps they would go to their mothers and complain, and the mothers would dismiss it as couldn't be true. I think we know enough about this problem to understand that it's a trauma, and people suffer from PTSD. There are mechanisms, psychological mechanisms that are activated, dissociative reactions where you see it happening to someone else. You may have difficulty being accessible emotionally, which is a defense, but it's the wrong reflex to be a good parent. So if you are poor, if you are affluent and you have access to professional help, you may have a better chance of recovering. And of course, people get through this without professional help as well, and professional help is no guarantee either. But if you're poor, you may not even know that professional help is available for this. You may feel very isolated and alone in it, as if it never happened to anyone else. Although with all the publicity about it now, there may be more awareness that this is a larger, broader problem. And so you don't have the wherewithal to pay for counseling. And if you get counseling, it's on a pro bono basis. It'll be a few sessions, and then you'll have to move on to someone else. So I think that the problem is perhaps more severe for those of low income, not because the incidence is necessarily higher, but because the ability to get out of that past trauma may be more difficult.
It's a recurring theme in the book.
Yeah.
Just limited access. I'm going to ask if there are any questions here in a moment. The two words that come up a lot in the book, invisible and hidden. This is a big problem in this country. There are many people who are suffering, yet we don't talk about it much, and many of the people who fall under that title, working poor, do remain, at least metaphorically, hidden or invisible.
Well, that's why I'm so glad that the university has made this book a vehicle for a broader discussion, not just on campus, but in the community, and that you have all participated in this, and that we're here talking about it, because it is a problem that's not discussed at the political level, and the press isn't very good at covering it either. And there are reasons for that we could go into, but I think that part of the reason it's hidden is that American myth that if you're working hard, you're not poor. I mean, it just seems like an oxymoron. And people, I keep thinking of the phrase from Edgar Allan Poe, hidden in plain sight. And people who are working poor are hidden in plain sight. We do encounter them all the time. We go to the store, see them stocking shelves, checking us out, as cashiers. The fruits of their labor are in our lives. When we sit down for Thanksgiving dinner in a few weeks, the sweet potatoes that we eat will have been harvested probably by the working poor. The Christmas trees that we put in our houses will have been cut by the working poor. These are folks who are often migrant workers in terms of agriculture, but are paid often on a piecework basis or a very low wage. And I think that they wear their jobs like camouflage. Because in America, if you have a job, you're not supposed to be poor. So you blend in. You're invisible partly because of our ideology, the truth of the power of the wish.
David Shipler is the author of the book, The Working Poor. He visited Fayetteville and the University of Arkansas last month as the guest of the annual One Book, One Community event. Our conversation was recorded in front of an audience at the Fayetteville Public Library. There is more to the discussion in just a moment. Excerpts from the question and answer portion of that afternoon. That's just ahead on Ozarks at Large.